are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Monday, September 11, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks. On a Michael Monday, this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Christy Thornton, a professor and faculty of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, fellow in the research on cluster and global transformations at Harvard University. We're going to be talking about the narco state to the north, how neoliberalism and economic oligarchy is the common threat that connects Mexico and the United States. And we'll also be talking about the relationship between Mexico's political leadership, the ongoing failed drug war, the cartels, and a new leftist party and movement emerging in Mexico. Storm Irma hit hard. About 2,800 people took shelter across Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, and 200,000 people in Florida alone. About nearly 7 million people have evacuated and power is out in many parts of Florida. This is, of course, after all of the devastation in the Caribbean and places like Barbuda. We're going to be checking in on that. Steve Bannon speaks to Charlie Rose, and it is just as disconcerting and quite possibly alcohol-fueled as you might expect, but as ridiculous and as dangerous as he is, he probably does have the right strategy for taking over a white identity party, the Republican Party. Hillary Clinton, she is not ever in any way, shape, or form going to take any responsibility. She is on her book tour, even as Senator Christian Gillibrand has come out for full public financing of elections in light of Kamala Harris signing up with Bernie Sanders for single payer for all, and Elizabeth Warren finally formally committing to support the Sanders bill. Record numbers of co-sponsors for John Conyers' single payer bill in the House of Representatives. The party moves, the Clintonists stay. All that and more on today's Majority Report. This is, of course, also, there are two devastating anniversaries. September 11th, of course, terrorist attacks, the World Trade Center, Washington, D.C., the Pentagon, the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. Not only were, of course, thousands of people murdered on that day and those atrocities, but that event has sort of set many of the sort of this kind of global tempo of the past couple of decades. And catastrophes in Iraq and Afghanistan and kinetic zones in Somalia and Yemen and everywhere else. And, you know, really, I would say September 11th, then the invasion of Iraq, and then, of course, the financial crisis of and global meltdown from Wall Street are the sort of three kind of defining patterns of the moment we're in. So we have September 11th. And then I also always like to talk about the coup in 1973, the CIA-backed coup in Chile, which deposed democratic socialist, democratically elected Salvador Allende, replaced with Augusto Pinochet, who was a true monster. And of course, when he wasn't ordering stadiums of people to be massacred or people to have their stomachs cut open and thrown out of airplanes so they could sink in the ocean, he was taking economics advice from libertarians. So those are the two September 11ths that we need to acknowledge. And I, in those moments there, I always try to learn from history. And in our first piece of sound today, there is a moment that apparently an approach that I share with Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. He was on Fox and Friends this morning. He was in Shakesville, Pennsylvania, and he was speaking with the Dum Dums on Fox. Check out this stretch.
Portion of the monument, but really a reflecting on how great this country is, the sacrifices we've made, and also talking about the change that 9/11 brought to all Americans.
Do you worry 100 years from now someone's going to try to take that memorial down like they're trying to remake our memorials today?
Well, I'm one that believes that, you know, we should learn from history, and I think our monuments are part of our country's history. We can learn from it. You know, since we don't put up statues of Jesus, everyone's going to fall morally short. And I think reflecting on our history, both good and bad, is a powerful statement and part of our DNA. So,
Ryan Zinke has a great sense of humor.
That it's just, I was going to call it a reach, but I like how they didn't even, he just, Kilmeade is so dumb and so lateral that he really could go from, how about we take down monuments that were constructed in the Jim Crow era to whitewash our secessionist terrorist past, to romanticize the American apartheid that we're practicing right now. And now people are saying, I actually kind of prefer that slaveholders and mass murderers not be honored anymore. Let's take those statues down. And then, you know, Kilmeade's like, yeah, I mean, pretty soon, when you take you take down Robert E. Lee, it's the same thing as taking down a monument that honors the victims of September 11th. Like, you know, Robert E. Lee, a firefighter who died trying to rescue people. Tomato, tomato. And Zinke's like, yeah, it's our DNA, man.
The next step in that conversation, which a guy like Ryan Zinke is careful not to get into, is what do we learn from these statues? Because I'm all for there's a historical lesson to be learned from these statues. Mm. It definitely is. But it's that, and he says, we can learn from our history, good and bad. Okay, well, are we saying that the Confederate statues are bad history that we should, like, that now commemorate, if that's the lesson we draw of it? But, you know, they never
I would never say that. Hey, so we know we're hiring. We need someone in here to help make it happen. You should see Matt. He was having a breakdown this morning because there wasn't another set of hands. There's a lot to do. And now we have a major tool at our disposal. What was it? Sam was talking about some. We had some like crazy rate of applicants as soon as we put up.
I don't know, but he is using ZipRecruiter.
Yes, he is using ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring, as we are, and don't know where you post your job to find the best candidates? Finding great talent can be tough. Thankfully, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right person to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on a candidate finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And one more time, go try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. I have not, clearly, I'm a bit bearded, but as soon as I have to shave this off, I'm actually going to Chicago this week, doing some work out there. I might need to shave. Actually, I don't know. I don't know, Matt. Maybe we, in today's world, we don't need to shave anymore.
I do.
Yeah. I still, at the end of the day, I'm a beard guy in some ways, but you shave, you look clean. You look professional. And there's no better way to do it than Harry's. Our old friends are back. For decades, one big razor company has been relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. So Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who are fed up with getting ripped off, started Harry's to fix shaving. Harry's knew that the only way to ensure quality, so they brought, they knew that there was only one way to ensure quality, so they bought their own blade factory. By taking less profit and selling directly to you over the internet, Harry's offers their blades at half the price. Just $2 a blade compared to $4 you'll pay at the drugstore. I mean, what I love most about shaving with Harry's is that I never cut myself with it. I have sensitive skin, and like it's a thick beard. Just it's just hands down the best shave I've ever had. I mean, that's all there is to it. It Harry's is like the full win. It's cheaper, it's to your door, it's better quality, it lasts longer, and it's a better shave. There's no way in which Harry's isn't superior. And that's why Harry's is so confident that you'll love their blades. They're going to give you a trial set for free. Just cover shipping. Your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic blade, ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shell gel, and a travel blade cover that's a $13 value for you to try. Stop messing around and get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer at a $13 value for free. Just cover shipping. To get your free trial set, including a razor handle, 5 cartridge blade cartridge, and shave gel, go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report. Tonight, usually we're live on Tuesday, but tonight the Michael Brooks Show is live Monday night, 7 p.m. Bhaskar Sunkara in studio. We're going to be talking about strategic socialism, and we're going to have a critique, a agreement and a critique of a new Ta-Nehisi Coates piece, which is making the rounds. Katie Halper is also going to come in later, and there's a whole lot more we'll get to. Thanks to all the patrons we have so far. We're at 6:20. We're live on the YouTube channel at 7 p.m. tonight. Patron/TMBS. Thank you so much. We get it. Life insurance can be confusing, time-consuming. And if there's ever a payout, you won't even be around to spend it. What one company is making it a lot easier. Policygenius.com is a place to go learn about life insurance, compare quotes from America's top providers, and save up to 40% on your policy. Their simple, user-friendly website allows you to work out exactly which policy is right for you and find you the best price. And if you have any questions, they have a team of licensed experts waiting to talk you through it. No call waiting, no pressing a ton of buttons to direct your call. You get actual customer service that is so important in today's world. And they don't just do life insurance. They can get health insurance, insure your pet, or even protect your income, whatever you need. If you've been putting off life insurance, you want to make sure the insurance you have, or you want to make sure the insurance you have is right for you, check out policygenius.com today. You can save up to 40% by just comparing policies. The quotes are free. There's no sales pressure and zero hassle. Policygenius.com. It's life insurance for the 21st century. We will be back in a moment with Christy Thornton on the Majority Report. Judge a city, judge a town, them want fi turn it in a cowboy town. Aye, we look and know. Judge a city, judge a town, them want fi turn it in a dead man town. Aye, them think them reach the ultimate, yo, but them no reach nowhere yet. Aye, them get caught in a internet. A society, I tell me them a intellect, them promote too much debt. We no look and know. Judge a city, judge a town, them a turn it in a bad man town. Aye, when I look and know, judge a city, judge a town, them a fi turn it in a cowboy town. Aye, want to scare you, sir. Love is the only solution, can stop a revolution. Just freedom, meditation, from war and illusion. Love is the only solution, that can stop a revolution. Just freedom, meditation, from war and illusion. But money rise and gone on them, think we done. Peter Tosh rise and gone on them, think we done. Jacob Miller rise and gone, them think we done. Gone is
like Silkim Rise and Gun, but look ya, Morgan family come.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Christy Thornton. She is an assistant research professor at Johns Hopkins University. Christy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Christy, you focus on Mexican politics and the relationship between the United States and Mexico and all the sort of variables that that includes. And obviously, I think in the popular mind, I mean, Mexico has sort of been at the forefront essentially because of the xenophobia that has, you know, propelled Trump to the White House in many respects and influenced his, you know, governance such as it is. That's sort of in the broader kind of popular mind. There's definitely a tabloid culture around Mexico. You have Breitbart, mm-hmm. which not only talks about immigration, but also you know, in some ways, they're giving you a ongoing sort of tabloid version of narcos right now in real time with a very sensationalistic coverage of the drug war, which also sort of fuels a lot of this anxiety that we see influencing our politics. But I would just, you know, hoping if you could just step back a little bit from that and explain what's happening politically on the other side of the border, to use that, you know, often used phrase, because some of the same dynamics that are infecting politics globally, which is that people are really finally getting fed up with elites, specifically economic ones, and the sort of failures of neoliberalism are very pronounced in Mexico. And maybe through that, mm-hmm. we can also start to realize the ways in which even these problems that we like to demonize Mexico over are really, they're still centered in the United States, whether it's drug war policy or economic conditions that, you know, lead to, you know, the types of challenges that demagogues exploit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We saw Trump make Mexico a real focus of his campaign literally on day one when he announced his candidacy, right? He did so by demonizing Mexicans. And so many in Mexico were really surprised, frankly, to be made the center of a U.S. presidential campaign in that way. And so that has had some interesting dynamics in Mexico. You're very much right that there is a sense of being fed up with politics as usual, being fed up with neoliberal economics, being fed up with the very corrupt government that has ruled Mexico for so long in that country. And so you saw the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has gotten some kudos recently for being able to kind of stand up to Trump a little bit. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting because he is a wildly, wildly unpopular president in that country. Mm-hmm. A few months ago, an opinion poll came out that put his approval rating at 12%. So he has overseen a series of scandals, from corruption scandals implicating himself and his family, his government, the forced disappearance of those 43 college students that happened in 2014.
Would you explain that just a moment?
Go ahead. No.
Would you just, because we cover this on the show a bit, but maybe just remind people of that student disappearance story, if you could take a minute on that and then keep going.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a really important part of what's going on in Mexico now. And one of the really crucial things that served to delegitimize the current government, the government of Enrique Peña Nieto. So in 2014, your listeners will remember that there was this case where a group of students from a teaching college in southern Mexico had attempted to basically commandeer some buses to take them to a protest. They were stopped by local police, some military forces, and 43 of them were disappeared. Six people were killed that night, and the 43 who were disappeared were all young teaching college students, none of whom has ever been seen again. The remains, fragmentary bone remains of one have been found under kind of suspicious circumstances. And what happened in the aftermath of that was not only a kind of shock and outrage at this happening, but even more so shock and outrage at the government's response to it, which was to delay, to confuse, and to deny. And so the government came out with what they called an official story of what they thought happened, but what they called the official truth, the historical truth. And that was very quickly proven, almost every aspect of it, to be a lie. And so that has really served to massively delegitimize the government in Mexico. And that's on top of a number of other, not only human rights abuses type scandals, but political and economic scandals related to the federal government. And so this is the context in which the president has a 12% approval rating. People are incredibly fed up. I lived in Mexico from 2012 to 2013, and you just saw people out on the streets constantly. On the day that Peña Nieto was elected, there was a massive protest in Mexico City. He had to be inaugurated behind these huge barricades and rows of riot police because so many people were opposed to his presidency from day one. And so you're very much seeing a rejection of this politics as usual. Trump coming in kind of throws a wrench in how that has worked, and I think is creating some really interesting moments for Mexican politics and for the U.S.-Mexican relationship.
Absolutely. So tell us where Peña Nieto comes from. Like, want to get like these sort of, because there's these broader understandings for all of these forces, right? There's everything from, you know, the United States relationship, actually, even in some cases, we'll get to it later, the DEA and a specific cartel in Mexico. There's the, you know, role of the sort of shift of centers of drug production going from Colombia to Mexico and how those relationships kind of affect state capture with cartels. And then there was also NAFTA opening up the drug market in the United States. But, you know, when you talk about Peña Nieto, he represents a party that has governed Mexico almost continuously. Is it since the 1920s? Maybe you can give us the political map of Mexico. Who are the different players? Where does Peña Nieto come from? Is there opposition from the right? Is he the right? Is there opposition from the left? What set this sort of broader table for where he comes from?
That's a great question. So politics in Mexico can be a little bit confusing because Mexico was a one-party state, basically from the late 20s up until 2000, when we had the kind of culmination of what people in Mexico called the democratic opening, the first time that other parties besides Peña Nieto's party, which is called the Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the PRI. So the first time that the PRI lost the presidency in its entire history was in 2000. That was in the culmination of there had been some regional sort of gubernatorial and legislative victories by other parties. They finally lose the presidency for the first time in 2000. It turns over to an opposition party. That opposition party was the long-standing conservative kind of center-right business party called the National Action Party, the PAN. And Vicente Fox, who has been one of these most vocal Mexican critics of Donald Trump, was the president who took over. He was a kind of bombastic, swaggering cowboy. He's from the north of Mexico. The party is really centered in Monterrey, which is a northern industrial city, had long been there. And so the kind of right-wing business class was really focused on this party. And so that opposition party, the right-wing party, the PAN, ran Mexico for 12 years. There were two, what we call sexenios, the two presidential terms. Vicente Fox was in power for 6 years, and he was then succeeded in the election in 2006 by Felipe Calderón. And Calderón was the person who really inaugurated the drug war as we know it in Mexico, what he called the war on drugs and organized crime. And so we had this 12-year interregnum between the PRI having been in power for 70 years, then 12 years of rule by the center-right business party, and then Peña Nieto came back to power. And he came back to power for a number of reasons. It's important to remember that he won. There isn't a second round of voting in Mexico. So he won with not a majority, but a plurality. He got 38% of the vote. And a lot of what the voters who voted for him said was that they were tired of the insecurity and instability that had come with Calderón's drug war. And so the massive increases in militarization and the massive increase in violence and murder that attended that after Calderón started his war on drugs in 2008 really scared a lot of Mexicans. And so some percentage of them decided that things were better. They were more stable back under the PRI, under this party that had run Mexico as a single party state for 70 years. So they brought Peña Nieto back to power. He was supposed to be the kind of boy savior of Mexico. He's very sort of classically attractive, very well coiffed. He went to all of the right schools. He wasn't known as being an intellectual. During the campaign, they asked him to name his three favorite books, and he could only come up with one. But he had this idea that he was supposed to be, he was supposed to turn Mexico around. Everyone was talking about the drug war and the violence. he wanted to, as he put it when he appeared on the cover of Time magazine, change the narrative about their narco-stained nation. And so that was really his push. He said, we want people to talk about what's going on in Mexico differently. And the reason that he wanted that was because he wanted foreign investment to come back to Mexico.
Right.
The instability and insecurity of the drug war had meant that U.S. companies were starting to say, we don't know if it's safe to invest. And so he had this idea that if he could turn around what people thought about Mexico, then he might be able to kind of turn the corner. Now, he didn't really change any of the policies with regard to the drug war. He did try to put in place a whole series of deepening of the neoliberal economic reforms that had been started the previous 20 years. And so basically, Peña Nieto, the first thing that he did was put together a coalition of the PRI, the PAN, and the left-wing party, the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution. He put those people together in the legislature, made a coalition to pass this package of neoliberal economic reforms. Basically, everything that hadn't been liberalized under NAFTA so far, mm-hmm. he was going to throw that in the pot. Mm-hmm. And that caused massive opposition. So when I was living there, you would see constant marches by teachers' unions, even government workers' unions, peasant groups, all of these groups that were going to be affected. One of the big things was the beginnings of the privatization of the Mexican state oil industry, mm-hmm. which had been controlled by the federal government since the late 1930s. So he kind of came in, kept the drug war status quo, but tried to deepen those neoliberal economic reforms. And so you saw a continuance of that insecurity and instability with a kind of doubling down on the neoliberalism that had been put in place.
With another kind of insecurity and instability.
I'm sorry?
I was saying with another kind of insecurity and instability.
Yes, well, in terms of the economic, in terms of the economic that goes along with those economic reforms.
Right, right, right. Well, yeah, and I was thinking of also the security situation too, in terms of the kind of violence that he didn't change. So, you know, kind of giving those sort of double play. But so the two, I want to get to the drug war aspect specifically, but first, I mean, back to Calderon, there was disputes about whether or not he was also legitimately elected, and that also gets to the sort of left alternative. Now, I understand that under Peña Nieto, that the sort of the PRD has maybe kind of been compromised in some ways, but there's a new movement, a new political party in Mexico, but it has its roots in a dispute about the legitimacy of the 2006 election. Can you talk about that, and then this new movement, new party that's emerging in Mexico?
Yeah, absolutely. So the right-wing party, the PAN, is a party that emerged in the 1940s, had existed for a long time. The left-wing party, the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, was a party that emerged in the late 1980s out of a previous fraudulent election, right? When there was a split within the ruling party, the PRI, and people on the left wing wanted to stand against the kind of establishment figures. They were shut out of the political system and so decided for the first time in the late 1980s, 1988, to split from the party and create a new left-wing party outside of the PRI. That was the creation of the Party for the Democratic Revolution, the PRD. And important people in that were people who are still in Mexican politics today, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, who is right now the front runner for the Mexican elections next year. So that party really emerged in the 1980s in the course of what we think of as the democratic opening. What has happened over since really starting immediately, but really over the last decade, 15 years, is the creation of a centrist faction within that party who are called the Chuchos. They are the people who align themselves with the PRI all of the time. And so it was after Ayotzinapa, it was after the disappearance of these 43 students, that a number of people within the PRD said, this party is no longer a party of the left. Mm-hmm. It no longer makes any sense. Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, who founded the party, turned in his party ID card. And that was when López Obrador stepped up and said, we need to create a new kind of political movement that is not compromised by all of this corruption. And he created his movement called the Movement for National Regeneration, Morena. And this was on the heels of he had run, as you said, in 2006 and actually again in 2012, run as a presidential candidate from the PRD. In 2006, there was massive fraud. And so it was very much contested. He sort of established a counter government set up in the center of Mexico City and stayed there for many months. And so he decided that that party no longer made sense and sort of founded this new movement. And it has been actually surprisingly successful. And so that is really a focus of a lot of new left energy in Mexico is going into this new party, Morena. And we saw that in the elections in the Estado de Mexico in June, Mexico's biggest state, where the upstart from Morena very nearly beat the pre-governor, which it's a state that has been governed by the pre continuously for 90 years. And now we see it with the polling, which says that López Obrador is the front runner for next year's presidential elections. And so the energy that's being channeled from these various social movements, from the opposition to Peña Nieto and all of the corruption, could very well go into this movement for national regeneration and bring López Obrador to power next year.
Now, is he more Lula kind of center left, like genuinely center left, but relatively moderate? Or is he, you know, I'm sure that people are kind of bring out like the Venezuela example, which is obviously more complicated than it's talked about here. But just in terms of the kind of general spectrum, is he like, because so much of what we call like, oh, this is some real serious leftist out in Latin America or the Caribbean is really just like a, you know, a social democrat who's like, hey, maybe the whole purpose of my country shouldn't be to sort of like, you know, go to the top 1% of my population and foreign multinationals. So like, I guess where is he on the spectrum?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. López Obrador has lots of critics from the left. There are definitely people much farther to the left in Mexico who see there's a long tradition within the Mexican left of kind of pragmatism. And so López Obrador is not an ideologue. He is not a socialist. He is a social democrat. He's very critical of the changes that came with NAFTA and the neoliberalism that has run the country for the last 25 to 30 years. But he's also a longtime politician, and he's also a deal maker. And so there are people on the left and in some of these social movements who look at López Obrador and they think maybe he's just more of the same, right? Maybe this isn't, you know, some clean break and new part of Mexican politics that we would actually want. And so there, he is definitely to the left, and gaining a lot of support from various sectors of the left, from various unions, those kinds of things. But he is not the Hugo Chavez the PRI and the PAN make him out to be, which is the smear that they use constantly. They use this against the candidate in the Estado de Mexico as well. They said, if these people come to power, we will have Venezuela here. And they just do that constantly to try and scare people. But López Obrador himself actually has a lot of people leaning on him from the left, trying to say, actually, you need to stand up a little bit harder. You need to fight a little bit harder for the kinds of social and economic changes that we want to see.
How did NAFTA accelerate Mexico's cartel and the growth of the sort of shift from the kind of primary center point from Colombia to Mexico of the sort of cartel world as the beginning of that part of the conversation?
Yeah, it's an interesting connection because at first blush, they wouldn't seem to necessarily have anything to do with one another. But what we saw was actually a Mexico that became much more open to the rest of the world, a Mexico that threw open its doors to exports. When NAFTA was proposed, the president who oversaw it, Carlos Salinas, he said Mexico is going to become a country that exports goods and not people. That was his promise. It was an entirely failed promise. The number of undocumented immigrants who came across the border surged after NAFTA, obviously because of the economic dislocations, most especially in the countryside. And so what we've seen since Plan Colombia, since the United States militarization of the drug war in Colombia really pushed so much of the drug trafficking north, in what people who are experts in this call a kind of balloon effect, right? You squeeze it at one end, the air all goes to the other end. So we saw that move into Mexico. When the drug trade really began to move into Mexico, it moved into a Mexico that was just much more open to the world, that was much more financially and commercially connected to the rest of the world. And so you've seen, for instance, one of the really important aspects of how the drug cartels have become so powerful is their ability, for instance, to launder money through international banks. And so when the 2008 financial crisis happened, one UN observer actually said if it had not been for the sheer amount of drug money mm-hmm. in the international financial system, in actual banks, there would not have been any liquid capital moving around the world, right? So the only actual money that was being deposited into banks that could move anywhere in 2008 was there because it was being put there by drug organizations, a massive number of which are in Mexico. And so you saw, for instance, HSBC, the British bank, they were found to have actually modified their teller windows to fit the massive suitcases of cash that Mexican drug cartel operators were bringing into the bank for laundering, for making legitimate. And so you see these kinds of connections. In addition, now as the drug cartels are diversifying, they're doing things not only like selling drugs and kidnapping and extortion, right? But they're also getting into markets for illegal petroleum, illegal logging, illegal mining. And so the opening of Mexico to the world is something that these drug cartels have absolutely been able to take advantage of.
So, yeah, and Plan Colombia is an important reference point. So when Calderon, and that he was the great accelerator, as far as I understand, of the sort of full-scale militarization of this conflict with, you know, support from the United States, obviously. And then at the same time, there's a parallel conversation about, you know, and there's nothing conspiratorial about this. It's just like people should think of it as like, you know, in any country, if there's an industry that generates billions of dollars and has an unbelievable amount of money and resources at its disposal, of course it has relationships with other business sectors and with politics. So there's the sort of militarization under Calderon, and then I think there's also the kind of broader sense that obviously the sort of cartel that – cartels have relationships with political parties. They have relationships with other businesses. And almost in some respects, could you start to see, first of all, spell out some of those connections? And are those in some ways also becoming proxies? Like, you know, an election in a certain place could also be, you know, an extension of a conflict between two particular drug organizations.
Right. I think that that's an interesting idea. So what we did see, there's a convergence of three phenomena in Mexico, right? There is this democratic opening that begins happening in the late 1980s, really culminates in 2000. There is the imposition of neoliberalism, both before and under NAFTA in the 1990s. And then there is the rise of the drug trade within. And so those three things really happen in a coincident fashion in Mexico, and they happen together. And so whereas previously under the control of the PRI, right, drug trafficking organizations that have long existed in Mexico, the Gulf cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, all of their kind of political operation happened through the party. So in a particular local municipality, let's say in Sinaloa, where there was what's called a plaza, the kind of territory of the drug organization, right, the cartel knew that they had to have the local party officials on their side. They were able to bring in the local PRI officials, put them on the payroll. They would therefore ensure that the police and the politicians didn't get too involved. They got a payoff, and the drugs moved through the area with relatively little violence. Once you see the fracturing of the political arena, right, and there starts to be more democratic competition, all of a sudden it's not totally clear exactly who needs to be paid off.
Right.
Once it's not the PRI is in power of everything, right, then there are competing kind of political moves that need to be made. And so that competition over political resources, really fractures the ability of the cartels to maintain this kind of lid on violence and on conflict. And then when Calderon comes in 2008, so in 2007, the Bush administration decides that they are going to really go after this with something called the Merida Initiative. Mm-hmm. People call this Plan Mexico, in that it's very similar to Plan Colombia. There's almost $3 billion in congressional appropriations to militarize the drug war in Mexico. That's followed by Felipe Calderon saying, yes, okay, now we're doing this. He brings the military into the streets with his war on drugs and organized crime. So that violence, the lid is really blown off of it. And you see not only this competition between cartels for particular pieces of territory, but competition over access to the political resources, access to the local political officials, to the party, right? And so the kind of corrosive nature of the drug money then becomes much more violent. And so in the context of that militarization post-2008, we have just seen this explosion in drug war violence. And it makes sense. You send the military out with guns to fight a war, you're going to get a war. And so we've seen something like 100,000, 120,000 people killed, almost 30,000 people forcibly disappeared. And the Calderon administration would say, look, it's just narcos killing narcos, right? It's bad guys killing each other. Eventually they'll kill each other off and we'll all be better off. And what we know is that that's not true, that the competition between these groups, the control, the fight for control over political resources has just left hundreds, literally thousands, 120,000 ordinary Mexicans dead in its path. And so that the ramping up of the violence that came with the militarization really further fractured this really precarious political situation on the local level. So again, one of the things that precipitated this, the implosion of the left party, the PRD, was that in that town where those students were disappeared, the Ayotzinapa school students, the town of Iguala in the state of Guerrero, both of the elected officials who oversaw that, the town mayor of Iguala, the governor of Guerrero, were both nominally from the left party. Oh. They were both PRD officials. Jesus. And so that was one of the things that they said, look, if this can happen in a place that's run by the PRD, this party doesn't mean anything, right? And so you can see the corrosive nature of the drug money and the drug violence that goes along with the militarization really getting into all of those political parties. And that's one of the things that López Obrador talks about, getting outside of that political system and starting his new party.
As a final question, and maybe you could also include this in explanation, I mean, just this sort of, and I think, you know, there's some obvious conclusions about how U.S. policy could at least, you know, tamp down on the heat of the situation, particularly in terms of demilitarizing the drug conflict. But I'm wondering if you could also, in addition to maybe some of those recommendations or suggestions that you might have about how policy could shift, could you tell us about the DEA and the Sinaloa cartel? And I think that also sort of reflects also things that we saw in Colombia, like maybe we're going to have an alliance right now with the Cali cartel because we're going to use them to, you know, leverage paramilitaries to go after Pablo Escobar. You know, all of those sorts of arrangements are happening there as well, and we're involved in every part of it.
Yeah, so an investigation by the Mexican newspaper El Universal, they got a hold of some U.S. government, Mexican and U.S. government documents that showed basically that the DEA was more or less taking it easy on members of the Sinaloa cartel, Sinaloa being one of the biggest and most powerful, of course, headed by El Chapo Guzman, who is now in federal custody in New York. There was evidence that as these cartels began to grow and fracture, that the DEA decided that its best bet was to kind of try and get some Sinaloa people in its pocket so that they could go after the competition. And of course, this is a tactic that we've seen, as you said, in Colombia, in Afghanistan, in many other places, right, where the United States law enforcement and military aligns itself with what they think of as the kind of controllable faction of a particular conflict in order to root out its opposition, with the idea that then they are going to go against the one that they're actually in cahoots with. But what we see is that what that ended up looking like was them actually just channeling resources, allowing this kind of drug trafficking to continue to happen. And so that investigation was really important. Of course, it's completely denied by the U.S. government, but it's the kind of tactic that we've seen in many, many places. Now, the important thing about the role of the U.S. government in all of this is that it's not simply the kind of military aid to Mexico, right? When the United States launches the Merida Initiative and there's $3 billion appropriated, somebody doesn't go down to the Mexican presidential palace and say, hey, Felipe Calderón, here's a check for $3 billion. Mm-hmm. What happens is the United States allows this appropriation to go forward so that the Mexican government can buy helicopters, drones, surveillance equipment. They can train soldiers. And all of those things happen here in the United States. They happen here with military contractors. And so much of that money from the Merida Initiative, for instance, goes to firms like General Dynamics and Sikorsky Helicopter. Those are giant business concerns, defense contractors, that provide a lot of important jobs for Americans, right? High-level manufacturing jobs that continue to be very important. So the kind of baseline political economy of the U.S. militarization of the drug war as a domestic problem continues to be one of the things that we ignore that we need to pay more attention to. And now that's on top of course, the fact that the demand comes from here and the guns come from here, right? Right. There is not a single gun factory in Mexico. There is not a place that a Mexican can make a gun. All of the guns of the Mexican violence come from here. All of the demand from the drugs is from here. And the money for the militarization of it is all here in the United States as well. So that makes it a really important thing for activists here in the United States to focus on if we want to affect positive change over the border in Mexico.
Christy Thornton, Assistant Research Professor at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for joining us on the Majority Report.
Nice to be here.
Okay, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. Bunch to get to. Join the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. Use our link, Majority Report Kickback. Amazon, and jet.com, justcoffee.coop, get the Majority Report blend, give us a review on iTunes. You know all the ways. We'll see you in the fun half.
Situation.